I don't finish the thought, because I want her to ask me to finish it, to show a shred of interest, stop looking at me like a stranger, because we are not strangers. We've made a life together. We have a son. I've kissed every inch of your body. I've cried with you and laughed with you. How can something so powerful in one world not bleed through into this one? I stare into Daniela's eyes, but there's no love or recognition or familiarity coming back. She just looks mildly uncomfortable, like she's hoping I'll leave. Do you want to get a cup of coffee? I ask. She smiles, now severely uncomfortable. I mean, after you get off, whenever that is. If she says yes, Amanda will kill me. I'm already late meeting her back at the hotel. We're supposed to return to the box this afternoon. But Daniela isn't going to say yes. She's biting her lip like she always does when she's nervous, no doubt trying to come up with some reason beyond a blanket, ego-destroying, no. But I can see she's drawing a blank, that she's working up the nerve to drop the hammer on my foundering ass. You know what? I say. Never mind. I'm sorry. I've put you on the spot. Fuck. I'm dying. It's one thing to get shot down by a total stranger. Another entirely to crash and burn with the mother of your child. I'm just going to go now. I head for the door. She doesn't try to stop me. Ampules remaining, 16. Every Chicago we've stepped into this last week, the trees are looking more and more skeletal, their leaves stripped and rain-pasted to the pavement. I sit on the bench across the street from my brownstone, bundled up against the bitter morning cold in a thrift store coat I bought yesterday for $12 with currency from another world. It smells like an old man's closet, mothballs and analgesic cream. Back at the hotel, I left Amanda scribbling away in a notebook of her own. I lied, told her I was going out for a walk to clear my head and get a cup of coffee. I see myself step out the front door and move quickly down the steps and onto the sidewalk, heading for the L station, where I'll take the purple line to the Lakemont campus in Evanston. I'm wearing noise-canceling headphones, probably listening to a podcast, some science lecture, or an episode of This American Life. It's October 30th, according to the front page of the Tribune, a little less than a month since the night I was taken at gunpoint and ripped out of my world. Feels like I've been traveling in the box for years. I don't know how many Chicagos we've connected to so far. They're all beginning to blend. This one is the closest yet, but it still isn't mine. Charlie attends a charter school, and Daniela works out of the house as a graphic designer. Sitting here, I realize I've always looked at Charlie's birth and my choice to make a life with Daniela as the threshold event that caused the trajectory of our lives to swing away from success in our careers. But that's an oversimplification. Yes, Jason too walked away from Daniela and Charlie and subsequently had the breakthrough. But there are a million Jasons who walked away and didn't invent the box. Worlds where I left Daniela and our careers still amounted to nothing. Or where I left and we both found moderate levels of success, but failed to set the world on fire. And inversely, there are worlds where I stayed and we had Charlie, which branched into less than perfect timelines, where our relationship deteriorated, where I decided to leave our marriage, or Daniela did. Or we struggled and suffered along in a loveless and broken state, toughing it out for the sake of our son. If I represent the pinnacle of family success for all the Jason Dessens, Jason too represents the professional and creative apex. We're opposite poles of the same man, and I suppose it isn't a coincidence that Jason too sought out my life from the infinite possibilities available. Though he'd experienced complete professional success, total fulfillment as a family man was as foreign to him as his life was to me. It all points to the fact that my identity isn't binary. It's multifaceted. and maybe I can let go of the sting and resentment of the path not taken, because the path not taken isn't just the inverse of who I am. It's an infinitely branching system that represents all the permutations of my life between the extremes of me and Jason too. Reaching into my pocket, I take out the prepaid mobile phone that cost $50, money that could have fed Amanda and me for a day, or put us up in a cheap motel for another night. With my fingerless gloves, I uncrumple the torn-out sheet of yellow paper from the D section of the Chicago Metro phone book and dial the circled number. There's something horribly lonely about a place that's almost home. From where I sit, I can see the room on the second floor that I assume serves as Daniela's in-home office. The blinds are open, and she's seated with her back to me, facing a giant monitor. I see her lift a cordless handset and stare at the display, not recognizing the number. "Please answer." She shelves the phone. My voice. "You've reached the Dessens. We can't take your call, but if you..." I hang up before the beep. Call again. This time she picks up and answers before the second ring. "Hello?" For a moment, I don't say anything, because I can't find my voice. "Hello?" "Hi." "Jason?" "Yeah." "What number are you calling from?" I suspected she would ask this right off the bat. I say, "My phone's dead, so I borrowed one off this woman on the train." "Is everything okay?" "How's your morning going?" I ask. "Fine. I just saw you, silly." "I know." She spins around on the swivel chair at her desk, says, "So you just wanted to talk to me so badly that you borrowed a stranger's phone?" "I did, actually." "You're sweet." I just sit there, absorbing her voice. "Daniela?"
"Yes?"
"I really miss you."
"What's wrong, Jason?"
"Nothing."
"You sound weird. Talk to me."
"I was walking to the L and it just hit me."
"What did?"
"I take so many moments with you for granted. I walk out the door to work, and I'm already thinking about my day, about the lecture I have to give, whatever, and I just... I had a moment of clarity getting on the train about how much I love you, how much you mean to me. Because you never know."
"Never know what?"
"When it could all be taken away. Anyway, I tried to call you, but my phone was dead." For a long moment, there's just silence on the other end of the line. "Daniela?"
"I'm here. And I feel the same way about you. You know that, right?"
I close my eyes against the emotion, thinking I could cross the street right now and come inside and tell you everything. "I am so lost, my love." Daniela steps down off her chair and walks over to the window. She's wearing a long, cream-colored sweater over yoga pants. Her hair is up, and she's holding a mug of what I suspect is tea from a local shop. She cradles her belly, which is rounded with child. Charlie is going to be a big brother. I smile through the tears, wondering what he thinks of that. It's something my Charlie missed.
"Jason, are you sure everything's okay?"
"Positive."
"Well, look, I'm on a deadline for this client, so..."
"You have to go."
"I do."
I don't want her to. I need to keep hearing her voice.
"Jason?"
"Yes."
"I love you very much."
"I love you too. You have no idea."
"I'll see you tonight."
"No, you'll see a very lucky version of me who has no clue how good he has it." She hangs up, goes back to her desk. I return the phone to my pocket, shivering, my thoughts running in mad directions toward dark fantasies. I see the train I'm riding into work derailing, my body mangled beyond recognition, or never found. I see myself stepping into this life. It isn't mine exactly, but maybe it's close enough.
In the evening, I'm still sitting on the bench on Eleanor Street, across from the brownstone that isn't mine, watching our neighbors arrive home from work and school. What a miracle it is to have people to come home to every day. To be loved, to be expected. I thought I appreciated every moment, but sitting here in the cold, I know I took it all for granted. And how could I not? Until everything topples, we have no idea what we actually have, how precariously and perfectly it all hangs together. The sky darkens. Up and down the block, the houses light up. Jason comes home. I'm in a bad way. Haven't eaten all day. Water hasn't touched my lips since morning. Amanda must be losing her mind wondering where I am, but I can't drag myself away. My life, or at least a devastating approximation of it, is unfolding right across the street. It's long after midnight when I unlock the door to our hotel room. The lights are on, the television blaring. Amanda climbs out of bed, wearing a t-shirt and pajama bottoms. I close the door softly behind me. I say, "I'm sorry."
"You asshole."
"I had a bad day."
"You had a bad day."
Amanda, charging toward me, she shoves me with both hands as hard as she can, sending me crashing back into the door. She says,
"I thought you left me. Then I thought something had happened to you. I had no way to get in touch with you. I started calling hospitals, giving them your physical description."
"I would never just leave you."
"How am I supposed to know that? You scared me."
"I'm sorry, Amanda."
"Where have you been?"
She has me boxed in against the door. "I just sat on this bench across the street from my house all day."
"All day? Why?"
"I don't know."
"That isn't your house, Jason. That isn't your family."
"I know that."
"Do you?"
"I also followed Daniela and Jason on a date."
"What do you mean you followed them?"
"I stood outside the restaurant where they ate." The shame hits me as I say the words. I push past Amanda into the room, take a seat on the end of my bed. She comes over and stands in front of me. I say, "They went to a movie after. I followed them inside, sat behind them in the theater."
"Oh, Jason."
"I did something else stupid."
"What?"
"I used some of our money to buy a phone."
"Why did you need a phone?"
"So I could call Daniela and pretend to be her Jason." I brace for Amanda to lose it again. But instead, she steps toward me and cradles my neck and kisses the top of my head. "Stand," she says.
"Why?"
"Just do what you're told." I rise. She unzips my jacket and helps slide my arms out of the sleeves. Then she pushes me back onto the bed and kneels, unlaces my boots, pries them off my feet, and tosses them into the corner. I say, "For the first time, I think I understand how the Jason you knew might have done what he did to me. I'm having some fucked up thoughts."
"Our minds aren't built to handle this. Seeing all these different versions of your wife, I can't even imagine."
"He must have followed me for weeks. To work. On date nights with Daniela. He probably sat on that same bench and watched us moving through our house at night, imagining me out of the picture. Do you know what I almost did tonight?"
"What?"
She looked scared to hear. "I figure they probably keep their spare key in the same place we keep it. I left the movie early. I was going to find the key and let myself inside the house. I wanted to hide in a closet and watch their life. Watch them sleep. It's sick, I know. And I know your Jason was probably in my house multiple times before the night he finally worked up the nerve to steal my life."
"But you didn't do it."
"No."
"Because you're a decent man."
"I don't feel very decent right now." I fall back onto the mattress and stare up at the ceiling of this hotel room that,
in all its inconsequential permutations, has become our home away from the box. Amanda crawls onto the bed beside me.
This isn't working, Jason.
What do you mean?
We're just spinning our wheels.
I don't agree. Look where we started. Remember that first world we stepped into, with the buildings crashing down all around us?
I've lost count of how many Chicagos we've been to.
We're
not getting closer, Jason. The world you're looking for is a grain of sand on an infinite beach.
That's not true.
You've seen your wife murdered, die of a horrible disease. You've seen her not recognize you, married to other men, married to multiple versions of you. How much more of this can you take before you suffer a psychotic break? It's not that far off from your current mental state.
It's not about what I can take or can't take. It's about finding my Daniela.
Really? That's what you're doing, sitting on a bench all day? Looking for your wife?
Look at me.
We have 16 ampules left. We're running out of chances.
My head is pounding. Spinning.
Jason.
I feel her hands on my face now.
You know what the definition of insanity is?
What?
Doing the same thing again and again, and expecting different results.
Next time...
What? Next time we'll find your home? How? You going to fill another notebook tonight? Would it make a difference if you did?
She lays her hand on my chest.
Your heart is going crazy. You have to calm down.
Rolling over, she turns off the lamp on the table between the beds. Lies down beside me, but there's nothing sexual about her touch. My head feels better with the lights off. The only illumination in the room is the blue neon light from the sign outside the window, and it's late enough that the passing cars on the street below are few and far between. Sleep is riding in, mercifully. I shut my eyes, thinking of the 5 notebooks stacked on my bedside table. Almost every page is filled with increasingly manic scrawl. I keep thinking if I write enough, if I'm specific enough, that I'll capture a full enough picture of my world to finally take me home. But it's not happening. Amanda isn't wrong. I'm looking for a grain of sand on an infinite beach.
12.
In the morning, Amanda is no longer beside me. I lie on my side, watching the sunlight push through the blinds, listening to the noise of traffic humming through the walls. The clock is behind me on the bedside table. I can't see the time, but it feels late. We've slept in. I sit up, throw back the covers, look over at Amanda's bed. It's empty. Amanda? I start quickly toward the bathroom to see if she's in there, but what I see on top of the dresser makes me stop. Some cash, a few coins, 8 ampules, and a piece of paper ripped out of a notebook, covered in Amanda's handwriting.
Jason, after last night, it was clear to me that you've made a decision to go down a path I can't follow. I struggled with this all night. As your friend, as a therapist, I want to help you. I want to fix you. But I can't. And I can't keep watching you fall down. Especially if I'm part of the reason you keep falling down. To what extent is our collective subconscious driving our connections to these worlds? It's not that I don't want you to get back to your wife. I want nothing more. But we've been together now for weeks. It's hard not to get attached. Especially under these circumstances, when you're all I have. I read your notebooks yesterday, when I was wondering if you'd left me. And honey, you're missing the point. You're writing down all these things about your Chicago, but not what you feel. I've left you the backpack, half the ampules, and half the money. A whopping $161 in change. I don't know where I'll end up. I'm curious and scared, but excited, too. There's a part of me that really wants to stay, but you need to choose your own next door to open.
So do I.
Jason, I wish you nothing but happiness. Be safe. Amanda.
Ampules remaining. 7. By myself, the full horror of the corridor sinks in. I have never felt so alone. There's no Daniela in this world. Chicago feels wrong without her. I hate everything about it. The color of the sky seems off. The familiar buildings mock me. Even the air tastes like a lie. Because it isn't my city. It's ours.
Ampules remaining. 6. I'm striking out. All night I walk the streets alone, dazed, afraid, letting my system purge the drug. I eat at an all-night diner and ride the train back to the south side at dawn. On my way to the abandoned power plant, 3 teenagers see me. They're on the other side of the road, but at this hour, the streets are empty. They call out to me. Taunts and slurs. I ignore them. Walk faster. But I know I'm in trouble when they start across the street, purposefully moving in my direction. For a moment, I consider running. But they're young and no doubt faster. Besides, it occurs to me as my mouth runs dry and the fight or flight response kicks an initial dump of adrenaline into my system that I may need my strength. On the outskirts of a neighborhood where the row houses end and a train yard begins, they catch up to me. There's no one else out at this hour. No help in sight. They're even younger than I first thought, and the smell of malt liquor wafts off them like malicious cologne. The ragged energy they carry in their eyes suggests they've been out all night, perhaps searching for this exact opportunity. The beating begins in earnest. They don't even bother talking shit. I'm too tired, too broken to fight back. Before I even know what's happening, I'm down on the pavement, getting kicked in the stomach, the back, the face. I black out for a moment, and when I come to, I can feel their hands running up and down my body, searching, I assume, for a wallet that isn't there. They finally rip my backpack away, and as I bleed on the pavement, take off laughing and running down the street. I lie there for a long time, listening to the volume of traffic steadily increase. The day grows brighter. People walk past me on the sidewalk without stopping. Each breath drives a wedge of pain between my bruised ribs, and my left eye is swollen shut. After a while, I manage to sit up. Shit. The ampules. Using a chain-link fence, I drag myself onto my feet. Please. I snake my hand up the inside of my shirt, my fingers grazing the piece of duct tape that's affixed to my side. It hurts like hell to peel it slowly back, but everything hurts like hell. The ampules are still there, 3 crushed, 3 intact. I stumble back into the box and shut myself inside. My money is gone. My notebooks are gone, my syringes and needles. I have nothing but my broken body and 3 more chances to get this right. Ampules remaining. 2. I spend the first half of the day begging on a south side street corner for enough money to catch a train into the city. I spend the rest of it 4 blocks from my brownstone, sitting on the pavement behind a cardboard sign that reads, "Homeless, desperate, anything helps." The condition of my battered face must go a long way toward garnering sympathy, because I collect $28.15 by the time the sun goes down. I'm hungry, thirsty, and sore. I choose a diner that looks shitty enough to have me, and as I pay for my meal, the exhaustion hits. I have nowhere to go. No money for a motel room. Outside, the night has turned cold and rainy. I walk to my house and head around the block to the alley, thinking of a place where I might sleep undisturbed, undetected. There's a space between my garage and the neighbors that's hidden behind the trash can and recycling bin. I crawl between them, taking with me a flattened box, which I lean against the wall of my garage. Underneath it, I listen to the rain pattering on the cardboard above my head, hoping my makeshift shelter will last the night. From my vantage point, I can see over the high fence that encircles my backyard, through a window, into the second floor of my house. It's the master bedroom. Jason walks past. It isn't Jason, too. I know for a fact this isn't my world. The stores and restaurants down the block from my house are wrong. These Dessens own different cars than my family, and he's heavier than I've ever been. Daniela appears for a moment in the window, reaches up, pulls the blinds closed. Good night, my love. The rain intensifies. The box sags. I begin to shiver. My eighth day on the streets of Logan Square, Jason Dessen himself drops a $5 bill into my collection box. There's no danger. I'm unrecognizable. Sunburned and bearded and reeking of abject poverty. The people in my neighborhood are generous. Every day I make enough to eat a cheap meal each evening and pocket a few dollars. Every night I sleep in the alley behind 44 Eleanor Street. It becomes a kind of game. When the lights in the master bedroom cut out, I close my eyes and imagine I'm him. With her. Some days, I feel my sanity slipping. Amanda once said that her old world had begun to feel like a ghost, and I think I know what she means. We associate reality with the tangible, everything we can experience with our senses. And though I keep telling myself there's a box on the south side of Chicago that can take me to a world where I have everything I want and need, I no longer believe that place exists. My reality, more and more every day, is this world, where I have nothing, where I'm a homeless, filthy creature whose existence evokes only compassion, pity, and disgust. Nearby, another homeless man is standing in the middle of the sidewalk, having a full-volume conversation with nobody. I think, am I so different? Aren't we both lost in worlds that, for reasons beyond our control, no longer align with our identity? The most frightening moments are those that seem to be arriving with increasing frequency, moments where the idea of a magic box, even to me, sounds like the ravings of a crazy person. One night, I pass a liquor store and realize I have enough money for a bottle of something. I drink an entire pint of J&B. Find myself standing in the master bedroom of 44 Eleanor Street, staring down at Jason and Daniela, asleep in their bed under a tangle of blankets. The bedside table clock shows 3:38 a.m., and though the house is dead silent, I'm so drunk I can feel my pulse beating against my eardrum. I can't piece together the thought process that brought me here. All I can think is that I had this, once upon a time, this beautiful dream of a life. And in this moment, with the room spinning and tears streaking down my face, I actually don't know if that life of mine was real or imagined. I take a step toward Jason's side of the bed, my eyes beginning to adjust in the darkness. He sleeps peacefully. I want what's his so badly I can taste it. I'd do anything to have his life, to step into his shoes. I imagine killing him, choking the life out of him, or shooting a bullet into his brain. I see myself trying to be him, trying to accept this version of Daniela as my wife. This Charlie is my son. Would this house ever feel like mine? Could I sleep at night? Could I ever look Daniela in the eyes and not think about the fear in her real husband's face 2 seconds before I took his life? No. No. Clarity comes crashing, painful, shameful, but in the exact moment when it's so desperately needed. The guilt and all the tiny differences would transform my life here into hell. Into a reminder not just of what I'd done, but of what I still didn't have. This would never feel like my world. I'm not capable of this. I don't want this. I am not this man. I shouldn't be here. As I stumble out of the bedroom and down the hall, I realize that to have even considered this was to give up on finding my Daniela. To say I'm letting her go. That she isn't attainable. And maybe that's true. Maybe I don't have a prayer of ever finding my way back to her and Charlie and my perfect world. To that single grain of sand on an infinite beach. But I still have 2 ampules left, and I won't stop fighting until they're gone. I go to a thrift store and buy new clothes. Jeans, flannel shirt, a black peacoat. Then toiletries at a drugstore, along with a notebook, pack of pens, and a flashlight. I check into a motel, throw my old clothes away, and take the longest shower of my life. The water running off my body is gray. Standing in front of the mirror, I look almost like myself again, though my cheekbones stand out with more prominence from malnutrition. I sleep into the afternoon and then train down to the south side. The power plant is quiet, sunlight slanting through the windows of the generator room. Sitting in the doorway of the box, I open the notebook. I've been thinking ever since I woke up about what Amanda said in her goodbye note, how I haven't really written about what I feel. Here goes. I'm 27 years old. I've worked all morning at the lab, and things are going so well I almost shrug off the party. I've been doing that a lot lately, neglecting friends and social engagements to steal just a few more hours in the clean room. I first notice you in the far corner of the small backyard as I stand on the deck, sipping a Corona and lime, my thoughts still back at the lab. I think it's the way you're standing that catches my attention. Boxed in by a tall, lanky guy in tight black jeans who I recognize from this circle of friends. He's an artist or something. I don't even know his name. Only that my friend Kyle has said to me recently, "Oh, that guy fucks everyone." I can't explain it, even to this day, but as I watch him chatting up this dark-haired, dark-eyed woman in a cobalt blue dress, you, a flash of jealousy consumes me. Inexplicably, insanely, I want to hit him. Something in your body language suggests discomfort. You aren't smiling, your arms are crossed, and it occurs to me that you're trapped in a bad conversation, and that for some reason, I care. You hold an empty wine glass, streaked with the dregs of a red. Part of me urges, "Go talk to her. Save her." The other half screams, "You know nothing about this woman, not even her name. You are not that guy." I find myself moving toward you through the grass, carrying a new glass of wine. And when your eyes avert to mine, it feels like some piece of machinery has just seized in my chest, like worlds colliding. As I draw near, you take the glass out of my hand, as if you had previously sent me off to get it, and smile with an easy familiarity, like we've known each other forever. You try to introduce me to Dylan, but the skinny-jeaned artist, now effectively cock-blocked, makes his excuses and bails. Then it's just the two of us standing in the shade of the hedgerow, and my heart is going like mad. I say, "I'm sorry to interrupt, but it looked like you might need rescuing." And you say, "Good instincts. He's pretty, but insufferable." I introduce myself. You tell me your name. Daniela. Daniela. I only remember pieces of what was said in our first moments together. Mainly how you laugh when I tell you I'm an atomic physicist, but not derisively. As if the revelation truly delights you. I remember how the wine had stained your lips. I've always known, on a purely intellectual level, that our separateness and isolation are an illusion. We're all made of the same thing, the blown-out pieces of matter formed in the fires of dead stars. I've just never felt that knowledge in my bones until that moment, there, with you. And it's because of you. Yes, maybe I just want to get laid, but I also wonder if this sense of entanglement might be evidence of something deeper. This line of thinking I wisely keep to myself. I remember the pleasant buzz from the beer and the warmth of the sun, and then, as it begins to drop, realizing how badly I want to leave this party with you, but not having the balls to ask. And then you say, I have a friend whose gallery opening is tonight. Want to come? And I think, I will go anywhere with you. Ampules remaining. 1. I walk the infinite corridor, the beam of my flashlight glancing off the walls. After a while, I stop in front of a door like all the rest. 1 in a trillion, trillion, trillion. My heart is racing. My palms sweating. There is nothing else I want. Just my Daniela. I want her in a way I can't explain, that I don't ever want to be able to explain, because the mystery of it is a perfect thing. I want the woman I saw at that backyard party all those years ago. The one I chose to make a life with, even though it meant giving up some other things I loved. I want her. Nothing more. I draw in a breath. I let it out. And I open the door. 13. Snow from a recent storm has dusted the concrete and coated the generators beneath those glassless upper windows. Even now, flurries blow in off the lake, drifting down like cold confetti. I wander away from the box, trying to temper my hope. This could be an abandoned power plant in South Chicago in any number of worlds. As I move slowly down the row of generators, a glint on the floor catches my eye. I approach. Resting in a crack in the concrete 6 inches from the base of the generator, an empty ampule with its neck snapped off. In all the abandoned power plants I've passed through during this last month, I've never seen this. Perhaps the one Jason 2 injected himself with seconds before I lost consciousness, on the night he stole my life. I hike out of the industrial ghost town, hungry, thirsty, exhausted. The skyline looms to the north, and even though it's decapitated by the low winter clouds, it's unmistakably the one I know. I board the northbound red line at 87th Street as dusk is falling. There are no seatbelts, no holograms on this L. Just a slow, rickety ride through South Chicago. Then the urban sprawl of downtown. I switch trains. The blue line carries me into the gentrified northern neighborhoods. Over the last month, I've been in Chicago's that looked similar, but there's something different about this one. It isn't just that empty ampule. It's something deeper that I can't explain other than to say, it feels like a place where I belong. It feels like mine. As we cruise past gridlocked rush hour traffic on the expressway, the snow intensifies. I wonder, is Daniela, my Daniela, alive and well under the snow-laden clouds? Is my Charlie breathing the air of this world? I exit the train onto the L platform in Logan Square and thrust my hands deep into the pockets of my coat. Snow is sticking to the familiar streets of my neighborhood, to the sidewalks, to the cars parked along the curbs. The headlight beams from rush hour traffic slash through the profusion of snowflakes. Up and down my block, the houses stand glowing and lovely in the storm. A fragile half inch has already collected on the steps to my porch, where a single set of footprints leads to the door. Through the front window of the brownstone, I see the lights on inside, and from where I stand on the sidewalk, this looks exactly like home. I keep expecting to discover that some minor detail is off. The wrong front door, the wrong street number, a piece of furniture on the stoop I don't recognize. But the door is right. The street number is right. There's even a tesseract chandelier hanging above the dinner table in the front room, and I'm close enough to see the large photograph on the mantel. Daniela, Charlie, and me at Inspiration Point in Yellowstone National Park. Through the open doorway that leads from the dining room into the kitchen, I glimpse Jason standing at the island, holding a bottle of wine. Reaching across, he pours into someone's wine glass. Elation hits, but it doesn't last. From my vantage point, all I can see is a beautiful hand holding the stem of the glass, and it crashes down on me again what this man did to me. All that he took, everything he stole. I can't hear anything out here in the snow, but I see him laugh and take a sip of wine. What are they talking about? When was the last time they fucked? Is Daniela happier now than she was a month ago with me? Can I stand to know the answer to that question? The sane, even voice in my head is wisely suggesting that I move away from the house right now. I'm not ready to do this. I have no plan. Only rage and jealousy. And I shouldn't get ahead of myself. I still need more confirmation that this is my world. A little ways down the block, I see the familiar back end of our Suburban. Walking over, I brush off the snow that's clinging to the Illinois tag. The license plate number is mine. The paint is the right color. I clear the back windshield. The purple Lakemont Lions decal looks perfect, inasmuch as it's half ripped off. I instantly regretted putting the sticker on the glass the moment I did it. Tried to tear it off, but only managed to remove the top half of the lion's face, so all that's left is a growling mouth. But that was 3 years ago. I need something more recent, more definitive. Several weeks before I was abducted, I accidentally backed the Suburban into a parking meter near campus. It didn't do much damage beyond cracking the right rear taillight and denting in the bumper. I wiped the snow off the red plastic of the taillight and then the bumper. I touched the crack. I touched the dent. No other Suburban in the countless Chicagos I've visited has borne these markings. Rising, I glance across the street toward that bench where I once spent an entire day watching another version of my life unfold. It's empty at the moment, the snow piling up silently on the seat. Shit. A few feet behind the bench, a figure watches me through the snowy darkness. I begin walking quickly down the sidewalk, thinking it probably looked as if I were stealing the license plate off the Suburban. I have to be more careful. The blue neon sign in the front window of Village Tap blinks through the storm like a signal from a lighthouse telling me I'm close to home. There is no Hotel Royale in this world, so I check into the sad Days Inn across from my local bar. Two nights is all I can afford, and it brings my cash reserves down to $120 and change. The business center is a tiny room down the hallway on the first floor, with a borderline obsolete desktop, fax machine, and printer. Online, I confirm three pieces of information. Jason Dessen is a professor in the Lakemont Physics Department. Ryan Holder just won the Pavia Award for his research contributions in the field of neuroscience. Daniela Vargas Dessen isn't a renowned Chicago artist, and she doesn't run a graphic design business. Her charmingly amateurish website displays several pieces of her best work and advertises her services as an art instructor. As I trudge up the stairwell to my third room floor, I finally begin to let myself believe. This is my world. I sit by the window of my hotel room, staring down at the blinking neon sign of Village Tap. I am not a violent person. I've never hit a man, Never even tried to. But if I want my family back, there's simply no way around it. I have to do a terrible thing. Have to do what Jason 2 did to me, only without the conscience-protecting option of simply putting him back into the box. Even though I have one ampule left, I wouldn't repeat his mistake. He should have killed me when he had the chance. I feel the physicist side of my brain creeping in, trying to take over the controls. I'm a scientist, after all. A process-minded thinker. So I think of this like a lab experiment. There's a result I want to achieve. What are the steps it will take for me to arrive at that result? First, define the desired result. Kill the Jason Dessen who's living in my home and put him in a place where no one will ever find him again. What tools do I need to accomplish that? A car. A gun. Some method of restraining him. A shovel. A safe place to dispose of his body. I hate these thoughts. Yes, he took my wife, my son, my life. But the idea of the preparation and the violence is so ugly. There's a forest preserve an hour south of Chicago. Kankakee River State Park. I've been there several times with Charlie and Daniela, usually in the fall when the leaves are turning and we're antsy for wilderness and solitude and a day out of the city. I could drive Jason 2 there at night, or make him drive, just like he did to me. Lead him down one of the trails I know on the north side of the river. I will have been there a day or two prior, so his grave will already be dug in some quiet, secluded place. I'll have researched how deep to make it so animals can't smell the rot. Make him think he's going to dig his own grave, so he thinks he has more time to figure out an escape or to convince me not to do this. Then, when we're within 20 feet of the hole, I'll drop the shovel and say that it's time to start digging. As he bends down to pick it up, I'll do the thing I can't imagine. I will fire a bullet into the back of his head. Then I'll drag him over to the hole and roll him into it and cover him up with dirt. The good news is that no one will be looking for him. I'll slide back into his life the same way he slid into mine. Maybe, years down the road, I'll tell Daniela the truth. Maybe I'll never tell her. The sporting goods store is 3 blocks away and still an hour shy of closing. I used to come in here once a year to buy cleats and balls when Charlie was into soccer during middle school. Even then, the gun counter always held a fascination for me. A mystique. I could never imagine what would drive someone to want to own one. I've only fired a gun 2 or 3 times in my life, while I was in high school in Iowa. Even then, shooting at rusted oil drums on my best friend's farm, I didn't experience the same thrill as the other kids. It scared me too much. As I would stand facing the target, aiming the heavy pistol, I couldn't escape the thought that I was holding death. The store is called Field and Glove, and I'm one of 3 customers at this late hour. Wandering past racks of windbreakers and a wall of running shoes, I make my way toward the counter at the back of the store. Shotguns and rifles hang on the wall over boxes of ammunition. Handguns gleam under glass at the counter. Black ones, chrome ones, ones with cylinders, ones without. Ones that look like they should only be carried by vigilante cops in 1970s action movies. A woman walks over wearing a black t-shirt and faded blue jeans. She's got a distinct Annie Oakley vibe with her frizzy red hair and a tattoo that wraps around her freckled right arm and reads, "The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed."
"Help you with something?" she asks.
"Yeah, I was looking to buy a handgun, but to be honest, I don't know the first thing about them."
"Why do you want one?"
"Home defense." She pulls a set of keys out of her pocket and unlocks the cabinet I'm standing in front of. I watch her arm reach under the glass and lift out a black pistol.
"So this is a Glock 23, 40 caliber, Austrian made. Solid knockdown power. I could also set you up in a subcompact version if you wanted something smaller for a concealed carry permit.
And this will stop an intruder?
Oh, yeah, this'll put them down, and they won't be getting back up.
She pulls the slide, checks to make sure the tube is clear, and then locks it back and ejects the magazine. How many bullets does it hold?
13 rounds.
She offers me the gun. I'm not exactly sure what I'm supposed to do with it. Aim it? Feel the weight? I hold it awkwardly in my hand, and even though it isn't loaded, I register that same "I'm holding death" unease. The price tag hanging from the trigger guard reads $599.99. I need to figure out my money situation. I could probably walk into the bank and tap Charlie's savings account. It had a balance of around $4,000 the last time I looked. Charlie never accesses that account. No one does. If I withdrew a couple thousand dollars, I doubt it would be missed. At least, not right away. Of course, I'd need to somehow get my hands on a driver's license first.
"What do you think of it?" she asks.
"Yeah, I mean, it feels like a gun."
"I could show you a few others. I have a really nice Smith & Wesson 357, if you were thinking more along the lines of a revolver."
"No, this would do fine. I just need to scrape together some cash.
What's the background check process?" "Do you have a FOID card?"
"What's that?"
"A firearm owner's identification card that's issued by the Illinois State Police. You have to apply for it."
"How long does that take?" She doesn't answer. Just stares at me strangely, then reaches out and takes the Glock from my hand and returns it to its resting place under the glass. I ask, "Did I say something wrong?"
"You're Jason, right?"
"How do you know my name?"
"I've been standing here trying to put it all together, to make sure I wasn't crazy." "You don't know my name?"
"No."
"See, I think you're messing with me, and it's not a wise..."
"I've never spoken to you before. In fact, I haven't been in this store in probably 4 years. She locks the cabinet and returns the key ring to her pocket.
"I think you should leave now, Jason."
"I don't understand."
"If this isn't some game, then you have a head injury or Alzheimer's, or you're just plain crazy."
"What are you talking about?"
"You really don't know?"
"No." She leans her elbows on the counter.
2 days ago, you walked in here, said you wanted to buy a handgun. I showed you the same Glock. You said it was for home defense."
"What does this mean? Is Jason, too, generally preparing in case I possibly return? Or is he actually expecting me?" "Did you sell me a gun?" I ask.
"No, you didn't have a FOID card. You said you needed to get cash. I don't think you even had a driver's license."
Now a prickling sensation trails down my spine. My knees go weak. She says,
"And it wasn't just 2 days ago. I got a weird vibe from you, so yesterday I asked Gary, who also works the gun counter, if he'd ever seen you in here before. He had, 3 other times in the last week. And now, here you are again."
I brace myself against the counter.
"So Jason, I don't ever want to see you in this store again, not even to buy a jockstrap. If I do, I'll call the police. Do you understand what I'm telling you?"
She looks scared and resolute, and I would not want to cross her in a dark alley where she took me for a threat. I say, "I understand."
"Get out of my store."
I step out into the pouring snow, the flakes blasting my face, my head spinning. I glance down the street, see a cab approaching. When I raise my arm, it veers toward me, easing to a stop alongside the curb. Pulling open the rear passenger door, I hop in.
"Where to?" the cabbie asks.
"Where to? Great question." "A hotel, please."
"Which one?"
"I don't know. Something within 10 blocks. Something cheap. I want you to pick it." He looks back through the plexiglass separating the front and back seats.
You want me to pick it?
Yes. For a moment, I think he isn't going to do it. Maybe it's too weird a request. Maybe he's going to order me out. But instead, he starts the meter running and pulls back out into traffic. I stare through the window at the snow falling through headlights, taillights, streetlights, flashing lights. My heart stomping inside my chest, my thoughts racing. I need to calm down. Approach this logically, rationally. The cab pulls over in front of a seedy-looking hotel called The End of Days. The cabbie glances back, asks, "This work for you?" I pay the fare and head for the front office. There's a Bulls game on the radio and a heavy hotel clerk behind the desk eating Chinese food from a fleet of white cartons. Brushing the snow off my shoulders, I check in under the name of my mother's father, Jess McCrae. I pay for a single night. It leaves me with $14.76. I head up to the fourth floor and lock myself inside the room behind the deadbolt and the chain. It's utterly without life. A bed with a depressing floral print comforter. Formica table. Dressers built of particle board. At least it's warm. I move to the curtains and peek outside. It's snowing hard enough that the streets are beginning to empty and the pavement is frosting over, showing the tire tracks of passing cars. I undress and stow my last ampule and the Gideon Bible in the bottom drawer of the bedside table. Then I jump in the shower. I need to think. I ride the elevator down to the first floor and use my key card to access the business center. I have an idea. Bringing up the free email service I use in this world, I type in the first idea for a username that comes to mind. My name spelled out in Pig Latin, Asen J. Essenday. Not surprisingly, it's already taken. The password is obvious. The one I've used for almost everything the last 20 years. The make, model, and year of my first car, Jeep Wrangler 89. I attempt to log in. It works. I find myself in a newly created email account whose inbox contains several introductory emails from the provider and one recent email from Jason that has already been opened. The subject heading, "Welcome home, the real Jason Dessen." I open it. There's no message in the email, just a hyperlink. The new page loads, and an alert pops up on the screen. Welcome to UberChat. There are currently 3 active participants. Are you a new user? I click yes. Your username is Jason9. I have to create a password before logging in. A large window displays the entire history of a conversation. A selection of emoticons. A small field in which to type and send public messages to the board and private messages to individual participants. I scroll to the top of the conversation, which started approximately 18 hours ago. The most recent message is 40 minutes old. Jason Admin. I've seen some of you around the house. I know there's more of you out there. Jason 3. Is this seriously happening? Jason 4. Is this seriously happening? Jason 6. Unreal. Jason 3. So how many of you went to Field and Glove? Jason Admin. 3 days ago. Jason 4. 2. Jason 6. I bought one in South Chicago. Jason 5. You have a gun? Jason 6. Yes. Jason Admin. Who all thought about Kankakee? Jason 3. Guilty. Jason 4. Guilty. Jason 6. I actually drove out there and dug a hole last night. Was all ready to go, had a car lined up, shovel, rope, everything planned out perfectly. This evening, I went to the house to wait for the Jason who did this to all of us to leave, but then I saw myself behind the Suburban. Jason 8. Why'd you call it off, Jason 6? Jason 6. What's the point of going forward with it? If I got rid of him? One of you would just show up and do the same thing to me. Jason 3.
Did everyone run through the game theory scenarios? Jason 4, yes. Jason 6, yes. Jason 8, yes. Jason Admin, yes.
Jason 3, so we all know there's no way this ends well.
Jason 4, you could all just kill yourselves and let me have her.
Jason Admin, I opened this chat room and have administrator controls. 5 more Jasons are lurking right now, just FYI.
Jason 3, why don't we all join forces and conquer the world? Can you imagine what would happen with this many versions of us actually working together?
In parentheses, only half kidding.
Jason 6, can I imagine what would happen? Totally. They'd put us in a government lab and test us until the end of time.
Jason 4,
can I just say what we're all thinking? This is fucking weird.
Jason 5, I have a gun too. None of you fought as hard as I did to get home. None of you saw what I saw.
Jason 7, you have no idea what the rest of us went through.
Jason 5, I saw hell. Literally, hell.
Where are you right now, Jason 7? I've already killed 2 of us.
Another alert flashes across the screen. You have a private message from Jason 7.
I open the message, my head pounding, exploding.
I know this situation is totally insane, but do you want to partner with me? 2 minds are stronger than 1. We could work together to get rid of the others, and when all the smoke has cleared, I'm sure we can figure something out. Time is critical. What do you say?
What do I say? I can hardly breathe.
I leave the business center. Sweat runs down my sides, but I feel so cold. The first floor hallway is empty, quiet. I hurry to the elevator and ride up to the 4th floor. Stepping off onto the beige carpeting, I move quickly down the hall and lock myself back in my room. Spiraling. How did I not anticipate this happening? In hindsight, it was inevitable. Though I wasn't branching into alternate realities in the corridor, I certainly was in every world I stepped into, which means other versions of me were split off in those worlds of ash and ice and plague. The infinite nature of the corridor precluded me from running into more versions of myself, but I did see one, the Jason with his back flayed open. Undoubtedly, most of those Jasons were killed or lost forever in other worlds, but some, like me, made the right choices, or got lucky. Their paths might have altered from mine, through different doors, different worlds, but they eventually found their respective ways back to this Chicago. We all want the same thing, to get our life back. Jesus, our life, our family. What if most of these other Jasons are exactly like me? Decent men who want back what was taken from them. And if that's the case, what right do I have to Daniela and Charlie over the rest of them? This isn't just a game of chess. It's a game of chess against myself. I don't want to see it this way, but I can't help it. The other Jasons want the thing in the world that is most precious to me. My family. That makes them my enemy. I ask myself what I would be willing to do to regain my life. Would I kill another version of me if it meant I could spend the rest of my days with Daniela? Would they? I picture these other versions of me sitting in their lonely hotel rooms or walking the snowy streets or watching my brownstone wrestling with this exact line of thinking. Asking themselves these same questions. Attempting to forecast their doppelganger's next moves. There can be no sharing. It's strictly competitive, a zero-sum game, where only one of us can win. If anyone is reckless, if things get out of hand and Daniela or Charlie is injured or killed, then no one wins. That must be why things seemed normal when I looked inside the front window of my house several hours ago. No one knows which move to make. So no one has made a play against Jason 2. It's a classic setup. Pure game theory.
A terrifying spin on the prisoner's dilemma that asks, is it possible to outthink yourself? I'm not safe. My family isn't safe. But what can I do? If every possible move I think of is doomed to be anticipated or made before I even get a chance, where does that leave me? I feel like crawling out of my skin. The worst days in the box, volcanic ash raining down on my face, almost freezing to death, seeing Daniela in a world where she had never said my name. None of it compares to the storm that's roiling inside of me in this moment. I've never felt farther from home. The phone rings, snapping me back into the present. I walk over to the table, lift the receiver on the third ring. Hello? No response, only soft breathing. I hang up the phone, move to the window, part the curtains. 4 floors below, the street is empty, the snow still pouring down. The phone rings again, but only once this time. Weird. As I ease back down onto the bed, the phone call keeps needling me. What if another version of me is trying to confirm that I'm in my room? First, how the hell would he find me at this hotel? The answer comes fast, and it's terrifying. At this very moment, there must be numerous versions of me in Logan Square doing exactly what he's doing, calling every motel and hotel in my neighborhood to find other Jasons. It isn't luck that he found me. It's a statistical probability. Even a handful of Jasons, making a dozen phone calls each, could cover all the hotels within a few miles of my house. But would the clerk give out my room number? Maybe not intentionally. But it's possible the man downstairs listening to the Bulls game and stuffing his face with Chinese food could be duped. How would I dupe him? If it were anyone other than me looking for me, the name I checked in under would probably keep me undetected. But all these other versions know my mother's father's name. I screwed that up. If using that name was my first impulse, it would have also been another Jason's first impulse. So assuming I knew the name I might have checked in under, what would I do next? The front desk wouldn't just give out my room number. I'd have to pretend.